Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Leading Conversation with me, Tom Dawson-Scrobe, and my sidekick, former Blitzbok captain, Kyle Brown. I won't forget 2007. I was personally about to complete my honours degree and had some heavy work to do when the box, the Springboks that is, decided to make studying rather complicated. The box made us proud as they won the World Cup. They of course were led by none other than John Smith. So how lucky are we to have him on the podcast with us this week. John is not someone who flusters easily, and we were warned that you might battle to get below the exterior with John. John is now a CEO. He's been the CEO of the Sharks Rugby Union and was a player for a number of different clubs across the world. And of course, someone who's widely respected both in South Africa and internationally. In this episode, we really try and dig into John the person. What makes him tick? What he believes about leadership? When he first learnt about his own unflappability, this is a great story, and how his Springbok team were able to galvanise themselves despite rather large provincialism that existed at the time. Kyle and John are both keen athletes, but don't worry, this is not just a long chat about mountain biking. But the rapport in this conversation is wonderful and made for a very enjoyable time. Please do keep joining us and giving us feedback. It's been super to see how many listeners and followers we are gaining, and we really look forward to having you for the rest of the season. Enjoy John Smith. Cool. Well, welcome to another week. Kyle Brown, nice to see you. And how are we doing today?
Good, Thomas. I had a little ride this morning, but not nearly as far as our guest. But we've got some great trails in our backyard here, so we can just shoot out and have a quick up and down a mountain. So happy today, even though my daughter made it difficult to sleep last night. Smiling, nice. Though.
Shame. Okay, well, these are the trials and tribulations that I will at some stage of my life get to. And John Smith, it is lovely to have you. Thank you very much for making time. I know you've just ridden, was it 80Ks?
It felt like 180, but yeah, it was 82Ks today, day one of PE to Plet. So slightly tougher than I expected. I'm feeling slightly jaded, but tomorrow is another day, Tom.
But John, you've done triathlons, you've done epics, you've done a lot of, that's not your average behavior for a former front row forward, or are you trying to buck the trend?
I don't know, to be fair. It certainly wasn't by design, Tom. I got into it sort of by default with my mate from primary school who mentioned many years ago to get involved with epic, and I didn't know what epic was. And once I did one epic, then I did two, then three, and then all of a sudden you've got five epics, and then you get involved with a charity Ironman for the kids, and you're doing half Ironmans, and then all of a sudden people try and convince you that they think it's a good idea to do a full. It's not. But I think all of that, it starts to become a bit addictive. You have such a long life of routine and training and discipline and yellow shirts Tuesday and training together, suffering together, pre-seasons. And then, especially the mountain biking, there's a lot of similarities. And I think that's it. And I guess by accident, and thankfully so, it's been one of those things that have been a massively useful tool for me to transition out of, I guess, fairy tale land of rugby and sport into the real world. Because I've been able to hang on to a few things that, I guess, made me tick as a rugby player. And certainly, the mountain bike especially gives me that time to reflect, and sort of helps me. I think makes me better at what I do in the real world.
Yeah, John. I mean, I'm fascinated by that. Like, what made me tick as a rugby player? So, what are those things that you've been able to translate straight across to Ironman or mountain biking?
I wouldn't say I'm an expert on translating anything that has to do with Ironman. I mean, I sort of survived the swim. It's a weird sport, eh? Like, you swim, there's like, you obviously can't talk to anyone because there's just bubbles in the water. Then when you ride, you're not allowed to be next to anyone and talk to anyone, so there's no real banter. And then when you run, I'm so buggered that I can't keep up with anyone or talk at the same time while I'm running. So I wouldn't say that I'm an expert on giving you Ironman experience, but I think the things that mountain biking specifically do, or the things that I pull from mountain biking are, I think the one thing that rugby players, and I guess sports people, but I can only talk to rugby, miss is that camaraderie, being in the team environment, touring, banter, getting getting caught out doing something stupid and then getting mocked and then finding something on the other guy, or, you know, tripping at training, and or just stupid stuff that it's like makes almost everything interesting, you know, because you're like on a boys tour all the time. And if you don't have banter and you don't have a cool group of oaks that are able to laugh at themselves and each other without being nasty, then you've got quite a cool vibe. And mountain biking is quite similar. So like, yeah, we're here with a couple of riders that are part of Barney's Army that were supposed to do Epic, but that was delayed. And yeah, we're flipping out in cool places. We got our own little team vibe here. We, you know, we ride together. They did do a little bit of waiting for the Big Red today so that we could finish together. But it's those things that togetherness. And you asked what I draw from from what I did as rugby. And now I reckon things that are, and I've gotten a lot wrong in the real world, but in business, there's so much to pull from in terms of what we did successfully in successful teams that were able to win more than they lost. And tolerance, understanding of diversity, bringing people together to actually enjoy what they do. And it's quite tricky in the business world. And having a bit of a passion for and a pride for what you do. And those things are quite sort of important to a rugby team.
You mentioned tolerance and bringing people together, and I feel like one leads to the other. You know, you've got to be tolerant of everybody else to embrace the diversity, and then to obviously use the best of what everybody's got to make the team function as well as you can. Eh?
Yeah, tolerance for me, Carl, is probably the most important element. I think in almost everything, maybe I said this, but especially in our country, we've got so much diversity. And people always think that tolerance is about what you're willing to put up with other people. Tolerance is knowing that there's a lot of things that you do that irritate those around you. And, you know, often people mistake the fact that they do have to be tolerant of other people's different ideas, opinions, behavior, but that they also have to do that because fundamentally none of us are perfect. You know, yeah. I have a magnificent wife who's been with me through thick and thin.
And very tolerant.
And she's very tolerant. I mean, she's now so used to my snoring that when I'm not there, she can't sleep. It's too quiet, you know. So, you have to be tolerant and to teach people or a group about tolerance. It's quite difficult because the first step is to say there's actually a whole bunch of things about you that you need to understand. Sometimes rubs people the wrong way, and when you accept that, then you can sort of realize that it's a little bit easier to accept the fact that you actually accepting some other people's differences because you've got your own set of problems. So tolerance is a big step in any kind of environment, team, business, family. It's very important.
John, I mean, I suppose it leads us. I'm fascinated talking to you because we've obviously I've known you a little bit and we've seen you on the TVs and doing such fantastic things. But like when you talk to people around you, everyone will say, oh no, he's quite guarded. Like, good luck with that interview and what have you, you know? We're going to try our best to get the most out of you. But what would you say is the one value that you're most drawn to being around?
I tell you the one thing. Maybe the one value, one of the one or characteristic or traits that I would say I struggle to be around is insecurity and uncertain. Like people that are uncertain about themselves and insecure, and it's not a good trait to shy away from, because invariably those are the people that need. Need help the most. But I suppose I'm telling you that because I really enjoy being around people that push the boundaries, challenge me, have a different view, that make me think about my strong views, because I do have strong views and I am guarded and invariably, like most men, have an ego that is sometimes difficult to control. But I'm drawn to strong characters. You know, I like people in the room with me and having a wine and a coffee with someone or a group of people that that are interesting. And if for me, interesting is sometimes hearing things that aren't like how I would see them or think about them. So, yeah, I would say that's probably what I'm drawn to. I'm drawn to people that think a bit, that are, you know, challenge themselves and those around them. And that it's quite tricky because often those characters can be quite arrogant and off-putting. Mm. But if you can find someone that does that without sounding arrogant or condescending, oh, then you've got a really interesting person at your table.
John, I know we're going to touch on the Enneagram again and people need to keep going back to this, but John, you and I are the same Enneagram, eh?
What are you? I'm a number 8.
Yeah, I think I'm an 8. Was I remember we spoke in our group meeting, I said that I was a monster and you said it's okay. But the one thing I remember from my Enneagram profile was a similar quality in seeking out an equal. You know, I'm as you just said, I'm fairly intolerant of number 1 insecurity and incompetence. And what I actually seek out is an equal to match me, you know, 1-for-1 or have a go at me and make sure that I'm being pushed the whole time to seek the best out of myself too. So it's, you know, it's not, yeah, I suppose it is a fair bit of intolerance on my part to do that. But ultimately, I suppose I want to say it comes from a good place. I want to see the best out of people. So when they say to me, oh, I can't do this, I want to tell them, bloody hell, you can do it. You definitely can do it.
I suppose that both of us in that sort of group have to be, I mean, I'm not ashamed of that, but I think where you go, we got to be careful is that we don't use that as disrespecting or being just condescending of people that don't fit that criteria, you know? So I'd like to, people often say, what do you want people to say about you when you're gone? But I'd hate for them to say I was intolerant of a certain sector. I enjoy people. I dig, you know, I dig socializing. I dig chatting. I like interesting topics. If you really wanted to have an idea of my Enneagram active controller / my characteristics, let's give that truck a chance to go up the hill. You get a very good idea.
Was it actual truck?
That's a truck outside. You get a very good idea of me when you met my wife, and I think that's probably why I've got such an amazing relationship with her. She's my best mate. She irritates the crap out of me sometimes, but she's flipping, never just sits down. She's, you know, we talk. I mean, yeah, she pushes all the questions to me that sometimes I don't want to be asked, and I think she's like the perfect example of someone that you know, keeps me entertained and interested and challenged all the time, you know. So, and again, hopefully she's not going to watch this podcast, but she's not an easy, you know, she's not a happy go lucky, easy to get along. You know? She's not everyone's cup of tea, but flip, she's just, you know, she's been amazing for me. She's like the perfect fit for me. And because she fits all those criteria, I guess, that I'm looking for as a number 8.
Mm. Jeez, it's a wonderful amount of self-awareness that you've got that you obviously would have. John, I was telling you offline that I spoke to some professional cricket coaches yesterday, and we spoke about a significant moment in your life that helped you change your behavior. And what was that? And I'm gonna ask you the same question.
I'd probably say there were two moments. One was really, the most significant moment was without doubt, I think I was 10 years old, and at the time, an aspiring tennis player trying to get to Wimbledon, convinced that I was, you know, going to be the next Ivan Lendl, who at the time was my hero.
You're giving your age away.
And I mean, being the ginger that I am, I had an unbelievable, I mean, again, it'll sound strange because people always think I'm calm and collected, but I had a massive temper. And as a tennis player, I lost my rag. I got worked up. I got flipping frustrated. And I wasn't pleasant to watch. And my mom used to take me to all these ATP tournaments, and I would competes every holiday and drive all over Gauteng. This one tournament, I was playing in the first round, and I was playing against, I promise you, and like the guy I was playing against was semi-retarded. He wasn't a very competitive player, and I was actually losing to this guy because he wasn't good, but he was getting everything back, putting air on it, and I was just making mistake after mistake. And eventually I lost my rag and I wanted to throw my racket into the fence. And you know, at the bottom, there's like a little ridge and it hooked onto my finger and the racket went sideways and past my opponent's head. Luckily didn't hit him, but it was flipping embarrassing. And then I realized it was going to get more embarrassing because my mom stepped onto the course, onto the tennis court, and told me to fetch my bag and my racket and meet her in the car. And so she pulled me out of the tournament before I'd even lost in the first round, and got in the car and she said, if you can't control your behavior, I'll never let you play sport again. So wow. I had to learn how to control my emotions at a young age. At 10 years old, I realized I loved sports, anything with a ball, like it was my whole life. So I quickly realized that if I got to control my temper and learn how to control my emotions, that's what I'm going to do just so that I can play sport. And I guess it was a sort of a career defining moment. The second one was probably a little bit later, and it was when I lost my 100th test to the All Blacks at the FNB in Soweto. And I was super bleak. I'd missed the tackle on Nonu for the line break right at the death. I think Richie scored in the corner, and it was a tough moment. I really came out there like sulking and feeling sorry for myself. And my wife actually said to me, you know, if you can't celebrate having played 100 tests purely because you've lost one out of that 100, then you're missing the point of what you've been able to achieve over 100 tests. And it was a valuable lesson at a much older age for me. Because often we take for granted the things that we have and what we've been able to do purely because sometimes we'll focus so too much on one failure, whereas without those failures, you know, we aren't able to progress higher.
Mm-hmm. Sure, that's so interesting, John. The reason I even thought to ask you that question was where you talked about challenge. Now, I reckon 80% of the people who spoke on that conversation yesterday, there was something where they got challenged or something went wrong or failed that was significant for them. And I was playing in my mind, you know, you hear so much of more recent, you know, we must encourage people and we must give positive affirmation, of all of which I agree with. But when you go to the crux of what's actually changed people, it's often something that was quite tough or quite difficult, or someone significantly challenged you. So how do you see the balance between challenging, even in the environment within which you work now, between challenging people to get them to be better and giving affirmation and positive praise?
It is a tricky thing. And maybe the way to relate the story is to almost talk about it from a parental point of view. Being a parent's tough, and there's so many different books and ways and techniques of raising your kids. And, you know, it's quite difficult. I've got two daughters and a son, and they're all three very different characters. And you're faced with different characters in your team and your business. And without doubt, we apply different strategies to our three different kids. Like, you know, with one, we can put massive pressure and that the child will come out on top. The other one, zero pressure, and then the third child, you've sort of got a healthy amount of pressure, but you can't go too hard because it's the kid will implode. We'll take strain and the pressure will be too much. So I don't think that the answer is to just go, bad luck, you know, you got 50% or 40%, and, you know, I'm sure you'll try harder next time. And same in business. You know, I've got people that work for me, and there's massive responsibility that comes with parenting and being an executive or a manager of a business. You have to encourage, but you also have to know what KPIs are, and KPIs are in everything. It's in your own personal makeup in terms of what's good enough for you. Then one day you won't have the ability to live up to your own KPIs. you're going to have to live up to someone else's KPIs when you get a job, when you get into a team and there's a coach watching you or a CEO or something. So if we don't instill a culture of KPIs in our children, I believe we're setting them up for failure later. And those KPIs are different for everyone. And maybe not the KPIs, the level of what you've got to achieve is maybe the same, but how you enforce those KPIs, I think, needs to be different for the type of character that you have. You know, I remember being in the BOC team, and we had so many different characters, and you got different colors, different languages, and a certain section of the group, you can honestly almost bad mouth them in a way that challenges them to get irritated, to want to prove you wrong, and that gets them to that place. Whereas then you'll get a different section, maybe a different cross section or culture or race, where you've got to actually more hold the hand and guide in the direction of where that KPI is and help, and how can I help you, and do you need extra session afterwards, and sort of use it that way. But KPIs and standards are important. I mean, if I let my kids just be happy and relax and not put any pressure, when they get into the real world, they're gonna get eaten up first, you know. So it's a flippin' tricky thing. But
yeah,
parenting is probably the hardest thing out of all the things that I've had to do, you know, because it's you are completely responsible in that first 12 years, well, maybe a bit longer, but where you have a real influence over ethics and morals, you have a real, real big responsibility to get it right. And you don't get it right every time. You don't.
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks, John. You mentioned briefly there the different people you worked with. So I want to take you back to your unbelievably successful tenure with the Springboks. I stand to be corrected, but I'm pretty sure you're a Soetie.
Sort of.
Yeah, my first language is English, yes.
Your first language. you're an English guy, captaining the Springboks. In the front row, which is quite diverse, but certainly the majority, I think, would be white Afrikaans-speaking men. What was that like for you, managing or captaining that side with all those different, or maybe A, being a minority, and I use that inverted commas, but also just captaining all these sort of, just captaining the personalities that you had around you?
We had a lot of diversity, and I can tell you right off the bat, you know, this one sector of white Afrikaans guys, that really wasn't the biggest challenge that we faced. In the beginning, when I took over as captain, it was provincialism. It was about Western Province, Natal, Lions, Free State Bulls, and the guys that sort of camped in those camps and didn't really switch around and didn't look mix up at Springbok level. So, one thing about when you have a strong group, whether it's a big white Afrikaans group or it's a big conglomerate from the Stormers that make up the majority of the team, or the Sharks or the Bulls or the Lions, I just found that as soon as you went straight to that group of numbers that had the power of number, that were the large majority, and you put out the fact that you were worried that, I would go to the guys that always sat together and say, hey, you know, it's one thing, we always talk about playing for each other and defending the line and having each other's backs. I said, but, you know, it's very difficult to have that kind of feeling and trust of someone if you don't step out and maybe have breakfast with a different guy. You know, maybe find out a little bit about something from someone that's not in your provincial franchise, you know? So, and when you sort of throw that challenge out, whether the group is an ethnic group or a language group or a provincial franchise group, it's amazing how quickly they feel they didn't notice, because it feels normal to them, because that's what they've always been doing. But it's amazing how quickly they realize the negative power that has. And if that group doesn't respond to you as a leader going there questioning the fact that this could be a risk to the entire team for South Africa, then you've got a massive problem. Then it's sort of, okay, it's time to maybe kick a few eggs off the bus. But I was very fortunate. And in my time, I had a really good bunch of blokes in our group, and we got along well. And if I challenged them, I did it in a way that wasn't personal, and I did it in a way that the outcome was only so that we could be better off together under the green and gold banner. And everyone was responded. I hardly ever had kickback on things like that, on integration. And so, and we didn't have racial issues, we didn't have language issues, we didn't have provincial issues, certainly not 2 or 3 years afterwards, because this culture took time to build of integration, you know. And it's just, I mean, I remember asking one from Pretoria, you know, about a guy's hobbies and likes that was from the Western Cape, and yeah, he didn't have a clue. And I said, well, do you think this guy's good enough to be in the team? He goes, yeah, Flippy's amazing. So I said, well, why is he not good enough to get to know and trust and build a relationship with, you know? So, but these are things that don't come to everyone naturally, and you've got to sometimes push those barriers. And I think that's sort of what made us close and got us, you know, together as a unit. We were under siege in 2006, and we'd lost 6 tests in a row. Every media guy was trying to get someone to turn on someone. And yeah, we stuck together quite hard in a very, very challenging time. And I think it's purely because we built that culture up by then.
John, I think we're gonna bounce a fair bit between sport and life outside of sport. And I'm quite interested to know if you're able to implement those similar things, you know, in your company, in your business, because I think a lot of people will look at what we're saying, and I think I've said a similar thing with regards to our team and how we're able to, the relationships form everything, and getting to know each other creates just a lot more depth to what the team is about. But I think a lot of people will look at it and go, yo, well, it's, you know, it's just easier to do in a sporting environment. Do you agree with that, or you disagree with it? And if you disagree, have you been able to implement those kind of things in the business?
It's definitely easier in sport. And purely because the quantum is just so much easier to define. And for me, the biggest challenge coming out of sport versus going into business is that in rugby, you know that you've either succeeded or failed. 1 week, it's like the period is 6 days. You play Saturday, yeah. You win. Well done, we're on the right track. We go again. Oh, we lost. Okay, flip. Now let's fix that. The line out, maybe the kicking game. And you've got 6 days and you fix it, and then you find out whether you fix the right thing 6 days later. In business, I think it's a big challenge for rugby players, sports people, to get around the fact that you've got to build on a certain strategy to increase your revenue, improve your EBITDA, create efficiencies. But these things, they're a much slower moving wheel. And in business, you've got a lot more people that are not on the same level of earnings. Because in rugby, most folks are sort of on the same kind of tin, and everyone's doing pretty well, and everyone's at a sort of a high LSM. And in business, it takes a lot longer with a much wider range of person from maybe remuneration is close enough, but it just, and you don't know, you won't finish on a Friday and go, geez, that was a great week. You know, we've increased EBITDA by 7%, because it doesn't work like it. You've got to wait for the numbers, and the numbers come 2 weeks after the month end. And then you've got to calculate that 6 months versus the previous year's first 6 months. And you've got to take a look at it. And it's just such a much longer, more detailed process. So it's pretty difficult. I mean, and I'm probably going to be a bit more guarded on how I talk about the things that I used in sport versus what I use in my company now, because I'm pretty sure someone from my company will see. But if I broadly looked at when I came in, it was a very successful business and doing very well, and it still is. And at the time, there were probably things that I thought could be done differently, because we've got three different sections to our business, and all three were trying their best to get the best numbers, make the most money. And almost like sometimes you get, Carl, in a rugby team where you have certain, when things are going bad, guys end up doing sort of, you know, acting in silos and making sure that just, you know, they make sure that their slate's clean. And when it comes to picking the team, that they've done nothing wrong and all contracts, and they, you know, they've kept their nose clean and their lineouts are okay and their tackle rate's high. But in business, one of the things that I am trying to bring to the table is that we're actually all on the same team. And you know, we sit as an executive, but in reality, our success is based on the lowest income earner being proud of what they do and doing it well, because we're in the services industry. And to filter down that sort of team ethic and the culture of togetherness in a business is a much bigger challenge than in a sporting team, because there's a big difference between an executive in a business and the sort of the entry level staff member who's actually the key to the success of your business. And you know, in rugby, your biggest challenge is keeping the guys holding the bags happy for a couple of weeks and making sure that they feel like they're being treated fairly. Whereas in business, it's a lot more complicated.
Do you, John, what's your relationship like with your entry level employee? You're the CEO. How do you get that right? How do you get the right building relationships with a cross spectrum of people?
Tom, it's almost impossible for me to have a relationship. We've got 6,000 staff members. They're spread across the country, you know, so we've got a national footprint. So, you know, the large majority of our staff I've never met and probably will never meet, because they're stationed in different towns and that. But I think it does start with your behavior. You know, how many people do you know that everyone goes to, well, maybe not anymore, but everyone used to go to work and at the front gate there's a guard or there's a receptionist. How many of the top executives know their names, ask them how they're doing, take notice? And I think it's a very small thing. And I like I said, in our business, we've got a ton of people that work for us. But I reckon the way to change that culture is, you know, if I'm the boss and I can greet the guy at the gate who's probably been there for the entire night protecting our premises, it's not a massive difficulty for me. And to pay a little bit of attention doesn't cost anything and show a bit of interest. And I guess that's a small way of starting this process.
I think maybe it might be a bit cliche to say, but isn't the small things that make all the difference? I mean, you don't have to go and make big sweeping changes for somebody to feel included or for them to feel appreciated. You know, just a simple good morning and how are you? I mean, like you're talking about the guy at the gate, how many people actually ask how are you and genuinely listen? You know, like they probably ask it on the fly, but whether they care or not makes a difference.
Yeah, it is. The small things that cost you nothing make the biggest difference. And Carl, it's the same in your marriage. It's the same in your business. It's the same in your team. Yeah.
There was some research done, in fact, about marriages, and they looked at one of the highest correlators to happy and successful marriages through doing studies. And it was just taking an interest in your partner's day was one of the strongest correlators. Nothing complicated, just, I love, how was your day? What did happen? And just taking a genuine interest. So I think it often is in leadership, it is the simplest things that make the biggest difference. So John, I want to go back to the Springbok thing. I'll be honest, I reckon a lot of people who are listening to this have no idea what the role of a Springbok captain actually is. Now, of course, we see you on the TV and you run out and you do the media. But like, if you were to mentor Sia, or if you were to mentor whoever will follow Sia, and you were to say, like, these are the things you're going to have to do that you might not know about, what would those things be?
Tom, there's a long list of things, and they don't seem obvious at the time. I mean, when Jake made me captain, you know, it was we were in a difficult spot. 2003 was dark, and Springbok rugby wasn't what I thought it would be, and you know, and Jake, I think Jake helped me figure those things out. And, you know, Springbok captain, you do have a massive responsibility, not just to your team, but in South Africa, you've got a responsibility to everyone. What they don't tell you is that if there was a contract written to be a Springbok captain, there'd probably be more things that you have to sign away than you would sign on for. So when I say sign away, I mean, you can't expect to have a proper private life. You can't expect to get away with doing stuff that most 20-year-olds would, you know, be sort of expected to do, and, you know, be smacked on the hand and say, "Oh, well, you must learn from your mistake." You can't. There's a host of things that you can't do, because if you want to be an icon and you want to take the accolades and you want to be a good captain, you've got to be on the field the same guy that you are off the field, the same guy that you are in your home with your kids. So consistency is a massive thing. If you took the role on and you were a massive rebel, and you know you swam upstream and that was sort of what you were want to do, then that's cool. Keep that consistency. But for me, you know, I guess leadership sort of did follow me around from school, and for me it was always about being consistent, and that if someone put me under pressure on the field, or in my home, or in off the field in a coffee shop, that my response would be exactly the same way. And that becomes very, very, very clear when you are under pressure and you're the captain of a team that's losing, and then people want to dig into your personal life. They want to dig into things that they might not know, to see if there's something that they can use to vindicate why your team's playing poorly underneath your leadership. And that, yeah. And at first it comes across as such a personal attack, but it's the way it is. And a lot of captains, I think, will get frustrated in their first 2 or 3 years, because the attention is amazing, and you can be at the top of the world when you're winning, but it turns in a moment as soon as the results don't come, and your ability to how do I say this, but you don't really get 9 lives as a captain. You've got to walk it quite straight from the time that you get this responsibility, and I think that it's a position in this country that people look up to, and they want people that look to them to be reliable, and that when they meet them in real life, if that ever happens, that they are not disappointed. And that, I think, is sort of the most difficult responsibility to live up to.
Mm. Now, you've mentioned consistency and you've mentioned challenge. You came in, as you said, 2003, difficult year. In fact, your quote was, Springboks wasn't what I expected it to be. And I've heard that from other people who played in that same rugby team as you, that same Springbok. They were like, hang on, this was my life's dream. And is this what it's about? Doesn't feel right. You've then gone through some successful periods, some dark days of 2006. You've then had, and then later some success in 2007, and then some difficult times where your place was questioned, and there was the whole sort of media circus around Bismarck du Plessis. Yet you've remained consistent. If you're able to tell us, like, how did you remain consistent? How were you able to, in those tough times when shit's being written about you and people are on your case? How?
Look, there was, I mean, before Bismarck, there was Gary Buerter and there was, I mean, there was always someone. You know, if you're a captain, you can't really have sort of too many average performances in a row. And I remember specifically Jay coming to me on several occasions saying, "Smitty, you need to forget the team today. You need to give me a good performance. You know, the flipping heat's on, and you'd have to deliver the goods." Remaining consistent, Tom, I think it was, I would say it was from my upbringing. My mom and dad, I'll never forget my mom when I sort of started getting slightly more well-known and recognized as a youngster. She phoned me and she said, "Look, whatever you do, don't let this stuff go to your head. And if I ever see you like Bob's against that with your shirt off in the middle of the Hays Canoes, I'm gonna kick your ass," you know. So I said, "Mom, to be fair, I don't think anyone wants to see me with my shirt off in the middle of the Hayes Comet, but I appreciate the sentiment. But I had my mom and especially my wife. I met Roxy in, you know, we met when we were 11, started dating in matric finals. And so I had those two strong women keeping me in check all the time. So I think consistency is really about keeping your ego in check. And it's difficult in rugby because in this country, you know, we hero worship the rugby players and you get treated like a king and you get stuff for free and you get bumped into the front of the queue and it's business class and good restaurants and sponsored cars. And so keeping your ego in check throughout all that is tricky. So if you don't have the right people around you that are helping you keep it in check, but you surround yourself with the wrong people that feed off of that free car, free dinner, free ride, then your ego, unfortunately, will get the better of you. And your consistency will fall out of the window.
John, I've heard from a couple different people on different ways to manage the highs and lows of sport, where they would, you know, essentially live in that middle band, where you never really actually buy into too much of the hype, but at the same time you protect yourself from the lows. Do you agree with that kind of thing, or I mean, did you ever use that kind of approach to things?
Maybe in a way, I probably had this. I had a similar approach around the media, and the hype is really about the stuff that people say about you. So, yeah, I was pretty careful about, you know. Often, my mom would say, "Oh, have you seen this lovely article in the newspaper about you?" And I made a pretty conscious decision that if I didn't want to take to heart the criticisms which always come, I couldn't really read the good stuff. So I actually stayed out of all the articles. I mean, I did a 1,000 interviews and I did all these articles and they're great for your profile and all the rest. But if you're going to buy into the good stuff, you then have to listen to the bad stuff, and you can't listen to the bad stuff. If you're going to take on criticism, it's got to be from people that you trust and that know you and understand your situation.
Yeah.
And there's some fantastic journalists out there, but there's no one journalist that will understand a Springbok backline player having a bad 2 days because his wife's ill and his baby's ill, or there's stuff going on that actually you can't share with the public. But this guy's now had 3 bad tests in a row. And, you know, but if you really want, if you're that backline player and you've got these issues, yeah, you go to your inner circle. And if you've got a good inner circle, you've got maybe 2-3 people, and it's hopefully one of them is your coach, maybe your wife or your pet, one of your parents or something. But I was careful who I took praise from, and I was always uncomfortable with getting compliments, and I was also very particular as to who I would listen to when it came to criticism.
Sure.
Speaking of criticism, I want to move the convo a little bit away from John Smith the person to your Springbok team. Now, I asked you the question around challenges earlier and what significantly changed you, and you told us the tennis story, etc., etc. Was there any moments in your Springbok team, in the time you were in the Springbok team, John, where there was a significant shift in your team almost as a collective being? Can you remember one or two of those?
I have touched on it, and I would say that for us in 2006, when we went through that horrible losing streak, we were tested plenty. We had journalists trying to get players to turn on management and management to turn on each other. And we had journalists trying to get players to turn on me as the captain. And there were shots coming in from everywhere. And it's funny, the worst is we actually, I think it was Buckabung. We ended up hiding out at Buckabung in preparation for the All Black test in the Royal Bafokeng Stadium. And yes, but the media flippin' followed us and they got in there, and we were under siege, and we came through that. We managed to win that test match by a sheer miracle of Rodney Sualu coming in from the side and Andre Pretorius putting the kick over at the death. And that sort of vindicated, because, you know, you beat the All Blacks, doesn't mean how many games you've lost, you're always going to look like a hero the next day in the media, and the country's going to love you. And we sort of got together off that test, and And we spoke about all the shots that had been taken and how we deflected all of them and we never turned on each other in that 6 week period. And I'm telling you right now, that was probably the week, that night, the guys flipping, we went out in Sun City and we got flipping properly, we celebrated properly. I think I came in with a few blokes at about 5 a.m. and my dad picked me up at 6:30 to drive me to Rustenburg for a family braai. I was in terrible condition, but that 7 day period made us realize that we were pretty tight and that not too much could get into through our honor.
What existed that made you stay so tight? That if it didn't exist, the media could have succeeded.
Mutual respect. And that was what we started building from day one. Breaking down the provincialism, breaking down the diversity, accepting people for who they are, building relationships with someone that you might not normally want to build relationships. Understanding that relationship doesn't mean you're going to go braai every Saturday, but that you have an understanding of the makeup of that ex-personality. But mutual respect and appreciation for the value of the group's potential to actually do great things. And those great things were, we were hell-bent on winning a World Cup, and that was a massive motivation.
Yeah. You obviously had according to reports, had a strong relationship with the coach, Jake White, who's still around, he's now at the Bulls. How did that relationship evolve over the years through thick and through thin, and what was the importance of that relationship in that resolve you developed as a team?
Yeah, Jake and I mean, we first crossed paths when I was at Pretoria Boys and he was coaching Jeppy. And my first game for Boys in 1994 was against Jake's last team that he coached at Jeppy. And Jake tried to get me to come to the Lions at under 21 level. And we then ended up playing under 21 World Cup with him as our assistant coach under Eric Sauls. And our relationship grew. You know, he took a liking to me from a very young age. And I guess I don't think there's ever been a coach that's backed me like that ever. I think a very large part of my ability to succeed and get to 100 tests and be able to go to World Cups and do well there was based on the fact that Jake just had this faith in me. And, it wasn't always sweet smell of roses. We would often debate, and we used to sort of shoulder the pressure of the Springbok team results together. But Jake was always very honest with me and flippy backed me hard. I mean, and our relationship has changed. I having him at the Sharks with me as the CEO, I think that would have been an unbelievably perfect match if at the time we had the resources to be able to let him do what he's been able to do with the Bulls. And the frustration, and I think certainly on the two of us in our relationship, was the fact that we just didn't have the resources. We couldn't, And one of the criteria was, come here, but you got to make it happen with what we've got. We just can't make wholesale changes. And we can see the difference that when given free rein, what Jake can do. And bearing in mind, I will always have massive respect and appreciation for what Jake did and always be a massive Jake White fan. But, he doesn't try to impress everyone. He is who he is. He has a way of doing things. And when allowed to do that, he's very good at it. But along the way, there's always collateral damage. There's always, someone that doesn't fit into the plan. And it's difficult because how do you softly tell someone, hey, I don't really dig the way that you play. Your style of that position doesn't fit into my plan. There's no nice way of doing that. So invariably, there's always going to be someone that has something to say about Jake, but it's purely because they just haven't fitted into his plan. And but that is the the joy of leadership. I mean, one of the most amazing things I watched during lockdown was that Michael Jordan series. Mm. And he was asked the question if he thought that his teammates liked him. And he sat back and he had the smirk on his face and he said, success comes at a price. That was his answer. He didn't say yes or no. He just said success comes at a price.
But do you think that's the case? Like, do you think the reality is if you're going to be remarkably successful, you are going to be a little bit polarizing?
look, we'll move a conversation away from Jake and we'll talk about it as from a leadership aspect. You need to be, you need to, as a leader of any group, you've got to be quite convinced of your strategy, and you've got to have a way of doing things. And that way is not just about a strategy of how to implement and how to succeed, but it's also about how to treat the people along the way. Some are dictators and they bully and they shout and scream and people scurry and get things done. And some are firm and fair, but also understand the human element as well. And it's funny, there's, you can see very different types of leadership, especially in the business world. Of there's some, you know, rock star CEOs that are arrogant, that wouldn't, you know, give two rat's asses about the staff that they've got, but yet they are unbelievably successful, their business successful, and they march on. And then you get CEOs that possibly take a bigger human element, and you know, they take a much bigger concern for their business, and they still have standards that they maintain. And I mean, I don't know, you'd have to ask my staff into which one I, or which category I fall in, but every leadership style has a different, has a different effect on the people and underneath him or her. And not always a positive one, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that business will succeed or fail.
Leadership natural or learned? Yeah.
A combination of both. You can be a natural leader and you can see it stand out in people, but if you're not learning as a leader and you only stay as, I mean, I'm a different leader now to what I was in 2007, purely awesome. Because I've interacted with other people and I've seen different leadership styles and I've picked at stuff that I dig and, you know, changed some of the things that I do. The thing about learning is that it's the fundamental, for me, the fundamental success of a good leader is someone who can listen. And the more you listen, the more you learn by default. Leaders that don't listen, they'll succeed possibly for a short period of time, but eventually it'll catch up with them.
Yeah. Tom, I think that touches a little bit on Paddy, what Paddy was saying about, you know, you ask the right questions, you listen a little bit, and you learn so much more about the players instead of trying to guess and sort of fumble in the dark and try to lead people that way. John, what he was saying was he's always seen, Paddy Upton is always seen as the guy who has all the answers. But what he said to us is in preseason, he would just go around having, you know, conversations with people. What do you look like at your worst? What do you look like when you're getting weak? What do you look like when you're under pressure? The player would tell him, and then he would ask, so what do you want me to say to you at that point? And the player would tell him. And then when that moment came around, sometime during the season, he would have the right thing to say, and the player would go, geez, you're a genius, you know? And it was all just because he would listen. He just listened to people, you know, and it's quiet and being there and asking the right questions. But
my gran had two amazing sayings. One was about stress. She said, stress is like sitting in a rocking chair. It keeps you busy but gets you nowhere. Yeah, yeah. And she also said, you've got two ears and one mouth and you have to use them accordingly.
That's so true. John, I want to finish with two questions because I'm mindful of your time and your meetings, and this has been unbelievably enlightening. If you could go back to yourself 14 years or 30 or more, 15, 16 years ago when you're captaining the box, something that you know now that you would love to go and tell your 20-something-year-old self, what would that be?
Don't buy as many muscle cars and waste your money on cars.
Tom, can I just ask?
No, I hope my wife watches this podcast.
the one question that we were quite keen on asking is, like, what are you noticing now about bringing people together and leading them that maybe didn't exist a couple of years ago?
I like to think that I'm quite open-minded, and I think the big difference, or that I've noticed, is that, you know, back in the early 2000s, you know, Flip, there was still a lot of unofficial pushback on accepting all the different people and races and colors and cultures in this country. I definitely feel that 20 years later, and I know we don't get that narrative in the media, and I think it's purely just to sort of build a political fire. But I do feel that people have got less issues with each other. They got less issues with the differences that our cultures and races have. There's a lot more acceptance. It's a lot easier to get a group together without having to deal with cultural differences. I just find that there's a far bigger, and I speak specifically on my experience in the last 8 years of being out of rugby and in business. I just pick up a much easier tolerance of diversity, and it's no longer really a stumbling block of having to figure out how to get people of different cultures together. It's really about figuring out common cause.
Cool. Great.
John, final question. We ask every guest the same one. You have to put together a dream team of you plus three people. The task is ambiguous. The challenge is ambiguous, up to you. Who would those three people be and why?
So definitely put my wife in there, because she gets shit done.
Now you wanted to what? Now you wanted to listen to this podcast.
I'm gonna WhatsApp her the link to this.
She's efficient, and she can be a panicker, and stress, but it fuels her ability to get it done, whatever the task is. So she'd be one of the three. Skulpberger, flipping, also super calm. Like under pressure, if we were there, not scared of grafting, makes difficult things look simple, and always got a smile on his face. And you'd also know that there'd always be a castle lager close by on whatever task we were chosen to do. And then I'll probably throw Shimmy in there. Shimmy flipping, I don't know. I just, every time I see Shimmy, he brings happiness to my life. That makes me laugh. And the other trait that I love about Shimmy is that we did this horrendous 200 kilometers in the desert last year. Shimmy, I mean, he's like, if you said to him, Shimmy, we got to do 1,000,000 kilometers, he's like, yeah, cool. You know, he's like, he backs himself, and he's like, nothing's too big. There's no big stress. He'll have a little moan, and then he just adds a huge amount of value, and I enjoy being around the guy.
Okay, so efficiency from your wife, sort of a calmness, but also the social element of Skulpberger, and the we often call Shimmy Hanyani Shimangi, will say that Hakuna Matata, you know, like nothing's going to faze him too much. And the sort of unfazed and also humor and willingness of Hanyani. So, that's great.
Okay. My wife's definitely got the short straw in this team. She's going to work the hardest.
Definitely. John, that was so, so lekker. What a privilege to chat to you. You're obviously an icon of our country and someone that we all looked up to. So really, really appreciate your time and wish you all the best in your endeavors. I know you did mention that you're getting more involved with the South African Rugby Legends, which is great that you're not lost to the game as well. So thanks so much for your time, and good luck with the next few 100Ks or whatever's left.
Thank you. I might need it off today, but much appreciated, guys. Go well.
Thanks so much, man.
Appreciate it.
Good boys.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Great. John Smith. Sure. Carl, I enjoyed that. Look, I had a privilege of working with him very, very briefly for a few months many years ago. So I got to chat to him a little bit. Always one of those guys that is... Yeah, he's just got an aura about him, doesn't he? He's just impressive to be around. Says the right things, but without being boring.
Yeah, I mean, we in the briefing up to this, we both threw out the word unflappable, and that's just John. You know, he's unflappable in everything we try to ask, every question we would try to dig nice and hard. But he's like, I think that's what he seeks out in other people, and he knows full well that he's very confident and very sure about what he knows and what he's been through, and he's had an immense journey so far, and he's got so much more to give to this country and I suppose to sport too.
No, I agree. I must say the one thing that I really liked, you know, you guys spoke about your Enneagram 8, just like this concept of challenge. Like, he is a nice guy and he is unflappable, but I also know from stories back in, you know, when he was the Springbok captain, that he wasn't shy to stand up for what he believed in. Yeah. And you know, he was very comfortable actually to go and stand up to the suits or stand up to management when something needed to be fought for. And I think my sense is that's what won him a lot of respect across the, as he called it, the different provincial divides.
Yeah, I mean, I just as you're about to say that now, I was just thinking that that's what would have won him the change room at the end of the day. You know, the fact that he was willing to put it all out there for all those guys around him and sort of take on any challenge that was making life a little bit more difficult for the players on the field, that's where players gain a huge amount of respect for a leader. So it's awesome to hear that kind of thing.
No, spot on. Well, thanks again. I think we will we'll probably move away a bit from rugby for the next few episodes we've got.
Do you know that a week in a...
I know that. We know who our next guest is, but we won't say. But we are going to move away from rugby, but some unbelievable guests coming up. But thank you very much, Kyle, and thanks everyone for listening. It was great to have you. Please follow us on Instagram at the.leadingconversation and on our LinkedIn and our Twitter profiles. It is great to interact with you and engage with you and hear your feedback.
Awesome. Thanks, everybody. Cheers.
Cheers.